This podcast is a presentation of University of California Television. Like what you hear? Consider making a donation at uctv.tv/donate so we can continue to bring you more great programs.
The title of the talk today is Can We Avoid Cognitive Decline with Age? Which I think is something we would all like to do. So to start with, I'm going to start with a little bit of background. Just to frame the talk, I'm going to talk about what I see as sort of healthy cognitive aging in terms of expectations, and then talk about the other end of the spectrum. So what is dementia and what is Alzheimer's disease? And then we'll get into the meat of the talk, which is modifiable risk and what we know about risk factors. And this has been a really exciting area of science in the last few years. So I'm really happy that I get a chance to share just some of this information with you today. Once we've gone over the observational studies into sort of correlations between risk and decline or risk and preventing decline, we're going to talk a little bit about clinical trials in this area and whether or not they show that changing risk factors might improve our cognitive aging. I'm going to talk a little bit about how we might get the message out. So I'm delighted today that so many people have signed up to listen to this talk. But there's so much great information that we as neuroscientists and geriatricians and gerontologists know now that we need to be able to share with the population more widely. And then I'm going to talk about you a little bit and what can you do today to improve or maintain your brain health. So we have a lot to cover, so I will jump right in. So as we age, some cognitive change is perfectly normal. It's to be expected. It's just the way our skin changes with age. None of us is going to get into our 80s or 90s without some wrinkles. Things change, and that's fine. Things change for the worse, and things change for the better. So we get a little bit slower cognitively with age. That's pretty much a done deal. It happens to all of us. And our brain gets a bit less efficient. It gets less quick at pulling up memories and at retaining and juggling information. So there is some normal decline with age. And there are some things that get better with age, and we all know that, right? So we know that we have more knowledge, more general knowledge as we get older, and we know more words and more vocabulary and more lexicon. And even if we can't pull that word up exactly when we need it, it's in there somewhere. So there are some things that improve and some things that decline, and that's perfectly normal. What isn't normal is dementia. And I'm going to talk a little bit about what I mean by dementia and what I mean by Alzheimer's, just so we're all kind of on the same page going into the talk today. So dementia is an umbrella term, and it covers various diseases of the brain which result in the progressive loss of cognitive function. And by that, I mean things like memory, language, problem solving, and other thinking abilities. And the problems had to be severe enough to really interfere with our day-to-day life and our independence to be called dementia. Dementia is caused by different brain diseases, and those include things like Alzheimer's disease, which is by far the most common, and other things like Lewy bodies, vascular changes, and things like frontotemporal dementia, which has been in the news a lot recently with Bruce Willis and other celebrities. Mixed pathology, so having more than one of these, is really common, and it's actually the norm for people with dementia. And that's going to be a little bit of a recurring theme of our talk today as well. So although dementia isn't the norm, it is really common. And all of us, unfortunately, probably know someone or have been close with someone who's been affected by this. In 2023, the Alzheimer's Association estimated that about 6.7 million Americans aged 65 or over were living with Alzheimer's disease. So way too common. Not inevitable. So one in three of our older adults, people over 65, dies ultimately with Alzheimer's or another form of dementia. And that's very common, but that means that two-thirds of the population never get it. However, the number one risk factor for dementia is age. And as our population ages, as we're getting, in theory, better healthcare and things like that, dementia is more prevalent. And that affects the individual, right? That affects the person who is living with the diagnosis, but it also affects their family. And we all know the emotional and also the practical toll that that takes on families. But it's also on a societal and healthcare systems level, a bit of a disaster because of the cost involved and the burden people need to be taken care of. So it's really something that we're all motivated, both on an individual and a more social level, to do something about. And we know with the loved ones that we've had who've been affected by dementia, that reducing or delaying those cognitive declines is going to be huge, both for us and for other people who may have to take care of us. So, and it's a necessity beyond that for our communities and our healthcare systems. So what happens in the brain with dementia? What are the actual cellular changes to start with that happen? So there's two key pathologies. One is amyloid beta plaques, and the other one is these neurofibrillary tangles. And the plaques form outside of the brain cells, and the neurofibrillary tangles form within the brain cells. There are other pathologies such as Lewy body and TDP-43, which we don't have time to go into today, but just to say there are other cellular changes that often contribute as well. Vascular changes are super common, and that's going to be another theme of today's talk. I'm going to go into that in more detail in a couple of slides. And inflammation changes. So here on this slide, we have microgliosis and astrogliosis. That's our inflammatory system, which gets involved in the pathology of Alzheimer's disease and ultimately helps to promote it. So vascular changes and inflammation are both really important factors in modifiable risk. These cellular changes cause brain cell dysfunction and ultimately death down the line. And this dysfunction and death causes a breakdown of the connections of our brain, which ultimately result in cognitive disruption and memory loss and other cognitive decline and brain atrophy or shrinking that you see there with this brain that's half with Alzheimer's disease and half healthy. So these changes happen in a certain order. So amyloid beta plaques get distributed diffuse in the brain quite early in the process, 10 to 15 years before we start to see clinical or cognitive decline. The cognitive decline comes when the pathological tau tangles start to spread within the brain. So we have this gap between when amyloid starts and when tau starts to spread about 15 years later, which we are calling the preclinical phase, which we're seeing as kind of a potential window to intervene. Once the tau tangles start forming, we get the atrophy and the clinical decline. So stopping or slowing that tau distribution is another kind of target of modifiable risk factors. The amyloid distributes diffusely early. You're seeing at the top there, these three brains where there's just this progression from lighter red through darker red of amyloid, but it's really not in a very specific location in the brain. It's kind of everywhere. And then once we get into more specific stages, there's just more and more. So it's not very localized. Whereas what we see with the tau tangles is they start very early when people are in their 40s or 50s. We might have a few tau tangles sitting in our transentorhinal cortex, and it's not really a big deal. It doesn't cause a problem. When it does start to cause a problem is a few years after we've had that amyloid build up diffusely. And for some reason, there's this interaction between amyloid and tau, and we start seeing this spread through the limbic region, which affects our memory, and then beyond into the other parts of the brain, which affect other cognitive syndromes. So we get this ultimate sort of cognitive decline and dementia, but it happens in these staggered stages. And as I mentioned earlier, mixed pathology, having more than one pathology in the brain, is normal. I really like this graph, which was produced by the Rush Alzheimer's Disease Research Center in Chicago. And they have a really nice diverse data set there with about 50% Black people and 50% white people. So that's why there's the two different pie charts here. And what you can see here is these are people who had Alzheimer's disease dementia clinically diagnosed during life, And then at death, they very kindly gave their bodies for autopsy and their brains so we could see what pathologies they had in their brain. And the blue sections there are the Alzheimer's pathology, just pure amyloid and tau and nothing else. And you'll see that's the smallest section or a small section of each pie chart. So about a third of white people and less than a quarter of black people with Alzheimer's during life have pure Alzheimer's when we get to the autopsy stage. Most people have Alzheimer's plus something else. So in light pink, they're Alzheimer's plus infarcts or little brain bleeds or Alzheimer's plus Lewy body. And the red, the people in red there, which is quite a sizable chunk of the chart on the left, have all three of those pathologies. So it's really kind of common. And I want to focus on those people who have Alzheimer's plus vascular, because the vascular system is something that we've known about for a long time, and we know that what's good for the heart is good for the brain. So I want to go into a bit of a deep dive on that topic. So this is the vascularization of the brain, all the blood vessels in the brain. And I love seeing this image, and it always kind of surprises me and astounds me that there is just so much blood pumping through our brains at any one time. And that's really important. This is another image showing an MRI of the brain and showing how branched those blood vessels are. And I like to think of it like trees, right? You have like a trunk and then you have branches and those branches go into smaller branches. And ultimately we get down into little tiny twigs. And those are the little capillaries or microcapillaries of the brain. And when we have either just with normal aging or more so if you have high cholesterol or hypertension, those little twigs get clogged and ultimately the blood isn't getting to them. And then the little bit of brain that they are serving or supplying blood and oxygen and nutrients to dies off. And we get these little white matter changes in the brain. So the bottom image there is the white matter structure of the brain. And the white matter provides the kind of road system where how information moves around our brain. And that's one of the reasons why we think the brain becomes less efficient and speedy with age, because it's getting kind of clogged up and the road system, the information getting from point A to point B has to go different circuitous routes, which takes longer and slows us down and slows down our processing speed and our attention and all of these kind of things. So small vessel disease of the kind we just described is very common with aging. It contributes to clinical decline, and it's associated with vascular risk factors like the ones I just mentioned, cholesterol and high blood pressure. Another major factor in clinical and cognitive decline with aging is inflammation. And this is, again, kind of nonspecific, right? It's associated with all sorts of things, stress or diet, vascular risk, etc. And importantly, it seems to be really important in driving that tau pathology, the tau spread through the brain. And inflammation is present in brains. It's part of the healthy function of the brain, even when we're young. But it becomes more of a prevalent process as we get older, and even more so in Alzheimer's disease. As you can see from these PET scans from colleagues in Pennsylvania at the bottom, where the redness of the picture is the higher level of inflammation in the brain. But let's talk a little bit about who is at risk for Alzheimer's disease. So there are certain non-modifiable risk factors. And as Danielle mentioned, a lot of my research is in sex differences, and I particularly hone in on women. And that is in part because being female is a major risk factor for Alzheimer's disease. And there's not much we can do to change that. Another non-modifiable risk factor, unfortunately, is race. So you'll see in this image from the CDC that if you're over 65 in this country and you're a non-Hispanic white, you have about a 10% chance of having Alzheimer's disease. If you're Hispanic, it's 12%. And if you're African-American, it's 14%. So there's a definite difference in risk based on race and ethnicity for various reasons. The other factor is genetics, and again, that goes in the non-modifiable category. But today's talk is really focused on modifiable risk factors. What can we change, and how can we improve our cognitive aging? So this is increasingly recognized as being really important. It might not change the initial pathology, the amyloid, although we think that maybe some things can, but it can perhaps change the vascular and inflammatory factors that promote the spread of tau, delaying onset or reducing severity. Two things that we're looking to do with modifiable risk factors are to add the resistance to pathology, so not getting the pathology in the first place, or getting it later than you would otherwise, or a reserve against cognitive effects. So having the pathology in the brain, but it not mattering so much, it not being such a problem for us cognitively. And it's important to note that a lot of people will die with a head full of amyloid and never have any cognitive concerns or problems. So it's really that tau pathology that becomes problematic and something that we want to avoid or diminish in its effect. What am I talking about when I say modifiable risk factors? So there was a really important paper that came out in the Lancet called the Lancet Commission in 2020 by Gill Livingstone. And she and her colleagues did a large review of the evidence and derived this beautiful plot, which shows that 40% of the risk for Alzheimer's disease and dementia more broadly is modifiable. And some of that is related to early life experiences, specifically education. 7% of the risk is maintained by the amount and quality of education you have when you're young. And that's really important for policy setting, and it's important for making sure our kids and our grandkids go to school and get a good education, but it doesn't help us much when we're adults. But other things do. So the midlife blue circle there shows things like hearing loss, hypertension, drinking too much alcohol, obesity. And then we get into this later life section in the purple, where we have depression, socialization, physical inactivity, diabetes, and the cumulative risk associated with all of those things can compromise a large chunk of our individual risk for getting dementia. So that's encouraging, right? Because there are things that we can do about those. A lot of those targets are really actionable and things that we can do something about. Of course, the actual risk factors are really personal, and the combination of risk factors that any one person has is going to be a little bit different. So as we're talking today, as we're going through this talk, think about what your personal risk might be, things that you might be able to improve. And maybe you don't have anything, which is fantastic. But if you do, then maybe you can start like making a little list of things that you might want to target in the future. So sex differences, again, this is kind of the lifeblood of my research. And as I mentioned, women have a much higher risk of dementia, and it's not just because we live longer. But unfortunately, 2/3 of Americans living with Alzheimer's disease are women. And women also have a different kind of trajectory of Alzheimer's disease than do men, where they have a third, like burgeoning of tau pathology during the mild cognitive impairment or MCI phase, which happens between when we have normal cognition, but before we have dementia and we're dependent on others for help. So when we have some cognitive difficulties, but we're still independent. And women also have a robust and responsive immune system, which puts us at higher risk for other inflammatory disorders which affect the body and the brain, things like multiple sclerosis, rheumatoid arthritis, and lupus. So along with my colleagues, especially Erin Sunderman, I'm interested in whether inflammation could be the key to the surge in tau. And if we can understand that, maybe it can help us learn how to restrict or slow the spread of tau. So for example, this is some work done by our former postdoc, Rachel Bernier, who looked at neuroinflammatory factors, specifically something called STNFR2 in the cerebrospinal fluid. So that's the fluid that fills the spaces in the brain, cushions the brain, and also coats our spinal cord. And when we look at that fluid, we can see a lot about what's going on in the brain. And what we found is that women show a much stronger link between cognition, in this case, something called the MMSE or the Mini Mental Status Exam, and inflammation, in this case, a marker called STNFR2. Whereas men who are in the light gray in that graph really don't show a relationship. So there's something going on with women where there's a stronger relationship. And we see it in other things too, with things like tau pathology, which was included actually in Rachel's paper, where women showed a relationship between inflammation and tau, whereas men did not. So there's something going on there, which was very motivating to myself and my colleague, Dr. Erin Sunderman, here she is. And it led us to produce a study, which is ongoing, called the Women, Inflammation, and Tau Study, or WITS. And in this study, we're looking just at women, and we're looking at whether modifiable risk factors, specifically sleep apnea, exercise, and insulin resistance, might predict Alzheimer's disease outcomes, specifically cognition and tau, and whether inflammation is a mediator of that, like something that pushes that relationship. So in WITS, we have women who are screened, they're 65 or older, they have some cognitive change, and they have a more than average genetic risk for Alzheimer's disease. These women are amazing. They come into our clinic in La Jolla and they have a lumbar puncture, a blood draw. They receive activity devices to take home to measure their sleep activity. They come back for another visit for cognitive testing and an MRI scan, and then another one for a tau PET scan. And then 2 years later, we repeat some of that. And we're in the process of analyzing those data, and I'm going to give you some little snippets of it as we go through the rest of the talk. So exercise is one of the things that we focus on in WITS. And the reason for that is because that's really robust evidence, I'd say more than any other modifiable risk factor, that this is associated with how we age cognitively. And this is a study that I love to share. It's by another of my colleagues and friends here at UCSD, Dr. Emily Reese, who was analyzing data from the Rancho Bernardo study, so just here in our backyard almost. She looked here at self-reported levels of activity at different decades in people who were being studied when they were older. And then she looked at the physical activity during these different decades in relation to their late life cognitive function. And what she found, and again, we have the MMSE, the mini mental status in the top left, she found that activity during midlife in your 50s and activity when you're older is predictive of better cognition. And the same kind of pattern is true of something called Trails B, which is an executive task where a lower score is a quicker score and a better score, where people's physical activity in their 30s and when they're older predicts better scores. And the same for memory, specifically in the bottom right there, when for the levels of activity when you're older. And this to me is really encouraging. It's correlational, so not necessarily causational, but we are seeing this relationship between activity levels, even when we're older, on our cognitive outcomes. And this is one of many, many studies that have looked into the relationship between exercise and brain health. And it's the one thing I think that is the sort of the leader of the pack with modifiable risk factors. Another thing that we really focus on here is sleep. And sleep apnea specifically is really common, especially in older adults. And after the age of menopause, so sort of 50s, 60s, it's equally common in men and women. It's associated with a higher risk of dementia. And excitingly, I guess, CPAP use. So no one wants to wear a CPAP machine particularly, but when people do wear them and they adhere to that, it delays decline. And I've seen this actually in clinic, where someone's come in with untreated sleep apnea and their testing almost looks like Alzheimer's disease. And then they go away and they really try very hard to adhere to that CPAP use every night. And then they come back and they look like a healthy older adult. So I'm a little bit of an evangelist when it comes to sleep apnea and CPAP. The reason why we think that happens is because when someone has sleep apnea, there's a diagram here, their airway collapses intermittently when they're sleeping, and that prevents the right amount of oxygen getting to the brain. And the hippocampus, which is the brain's memory center, is really an oxygen-hungry organ. And if we don't give it enough oxygen, it just doesn't behave. It doesn't do the consolidation of memories, which is meant to be doing overnight. So people get more forgetful. And then another reason that poor sleep is a problem for the brain is because the brain's clearance mechanism, the lymphatic or glymphatic system, clears amyloid when we have effective sleep. So if you don't have good sleep, you're not getting that quality overnight clearance. And that also causes problems. So we look at sleep apnea and sleep problems in WITS, and we've been really surprised by the prevalence, which has been about 80% of the women in WITS so far have some level of sleep apnea, and about 40% of those are moderate to severe. So it's really common. Most of those women had no idea that they had it. In women, it tends to present with less of the loud snoring and the gasping that you might see in men. So it's kind of a quieter syndrome and it goes under the radar. So this is some work by our graduate student, Kitty Liu, who has looked at these strong relationships that we're seeing between sleep apnea and tau, where worse sleep apnea seems to predict more tau in the women in WITS. But we get even stronger relationships when we just look at their sleep complaints. So if we just have them fill out a 10-minute questionnaire, we see relationships with tau in the top right there, section A, where the more complaints you have, the more tau you have, and with memory. So the green lines that you see there are a test called the brief visuospatial memory test, and we see really strong relationships between that and sleep complaints in our women. Another thing that we're looking at is insulin resistance. And we've known for a long time that untreated or out of control diabetes is a risk factor for Alzheimer's disease. Some people refer to Alzheimer's disease as type 3 diabetes. But we also know that pre-diabetes or insulin resistance is a risk factor for cognitive decline with aging. And this is just an example of research on that, where they've looked at a word list learning and recall task and the age of testing. And you see that the people with the lowest insulin sensitivity are doing worse on those memory tests in the light blue dotted line. So this again is, there's a lot of evidence for this. It seems to be even stronger in women, which is why we're including it in WITS. But making sure that your any kind of pre-diabetes or diabetes is in control is really important. And along those same lines, diet in general seems to be a good predictor of cognitive decline. So this is more data from Rush in Chicago, where they've looked at a special kind of way of categorizing the diet by looking at how closely you adhere to something called the Mediterranean DASH, or Dietary Approach to Systolic Hypertension Diet. And what they find is that people who adhere to this very healthy diet, who have a high score, are declining much more slowly over time in their study. So these are people who came into the study in their 60s and 70s, and now they have 10 years of data. And the heavy dotted line at the top there is showing much slower cognitive decline over time than the solid line at the bottom, where the score is low. And it's a little tricky to see, but some of the things that people get high points for on the MIND diet, just a questionnaire, is how many green leafy vegetables you eat, berries, nuts, olive oil, things like whole grains, fish, and then you lose points for things like fast food, pastries, and too much wine, unfortunately. Diet goes along with vascular risk, and we know that vascular health is really important for brain health. What's good for the heart is good for the brain. This is a former research assistant in the lab. Her name is Emeralda Sitlia. She's now doing her PhD at University of Southern California. And she did this study looking at the intersection between lifestyle and vascular risk, specifically with something called a Framingham risk score, which combines cholesterol, smoking, diabetes, and blood pressure with genetic risk. APOE4 status. So this is the strongest risk factor for Alzheimer's disease in all of the genetics, at least in white people. And we use the ADNI data here, which is the Alzheimer's Disease Neuroimaging Initiative. And what she found is that women who are depicted in red, who even have a little bit of vascular risk and have that E4 allele, have much higher tau pathology on these three different areas of their brain than do men who are measured in blue. So men have quite a flat line, even though they have that genetic risk. They don't seem to have this intersection with these vascular risk factors. Although we recently did a follow-up study and showed them perhaps BMI being obese might be a bigger risk factor for men than it is for women. So other important modifiable risk factors that I don't have time to cover today include sensory loss, and specifically there's really strong evidence for hearing. So if you or other people around you notice that you have some hearing difficulty, get it checked and then wear those hearing aids. Avoiding loneliness. This is something that's really interesting. Having good quality friendships or relationships, even just with one or two people, and that subjective feeling of loneliness that you could have even when you're surrounded by people is a strong predictor of cognitive outcomes. Blood pressure control, hypertension. This is something that we've known about for a while, but we've really seen that aggressive blood pressure control can be helpful. Risky medications. So there's a lot of medications that older adults are exposed to sometimes, which actually has cognitive detriment, and then chronic stress as well. So all important risk factors that we don't have time to go into in depth today. A couple of things that don't seem to work are supplements, unless you have a specific deficiency, like vitamin B12. People will sell you supplements for sure, but unfortunately we haven't found anything that is that quick and easy just yet. And the other thing that a lot of patients will come to will ask about in clinic are whether or not doing crosswords or Sudoku or other kind of brain activities like that might be helpful. And you know, they're helpful if they're enjoyable. This guy seems to be enjoying his crossword, which is great, but it's a sedentary activity. So I'm hoping that after he's done with his crossword, he goes for a half hour walk or something. Unfortunately, we haven't seen that crosswords and Sudoku puzzles and other kind of brain games have really strong effects on brain health. This is a study that I wanted to highlight just quickly because I think it's really exciting. So this is showing that even if you have a high load of amyloid on the left there, tau, or both on the right in your brain, if you have a healthy lifestyle, your cognition remains protected. So you might still decline, but perhaps over a slower period. And this is exciting because it means that even someone who's at really high risk, or even someone who's in the early stages of the disease, might be able to protect themselves in the future. But of course, all of the data that I've shown you so far has been correlational. And I do want to get into interventions and clinical trials just briefly. There have been a couple of really interesting studies coming out looking at multi-domain interventions. So recognizing that there's probably not one thing that we do that's going to fix this, it's probably multiple things. So this is a study that came out of Finland. It's very famous at this point. It's called the FINGER study, and it's launched a bunch of other similar studies across the world. We now have the worldwide FINGERs. This was a two-year multi-domain intervention where they helped older adults with their diet, exercise, cognitive training, and vascular risk monitoring. And they saw an improvement in cognition. If you tackle all of these things at once, you see an improvement in things like executive functioning in the top right there, and processing speed. So things that are really reliant on that vascular system being healthy and those brain roads, the white matter being healthy. They didn't see an improvement, interestingly, in memory, which is the area that's affected earliest in Alzheimer's disease. But you know what? I would take it. Like, if my brain can be quicker and more efficient, I think it's probably worth it. And all of these activities as well, just to mention on the side, are going to improve your overall well-being, your physical well-being, as well as your brain health. his finger went so well, they're continuing it. And now they're looking at insulin resistance as well. So they're adding metformin, which is a diabetes drug, which is pretty safe. It's pretty cheap. And they're adding, so some people are getting just the lysyl intervention in this latest study that they're conducting at the moment. Some people are getting low dose and some people are getting high dose of metformin. So that'll be a really exciting study to keep an eye on and see what they find. Another study more locally by Christine Yaff, who's at UCSF, and Eric Larson, who's in University of Washington in Seattle, did a similar thing where they help people get through various risk factors at once with a personalized intervention with coaches. And unfortunately for Dr. Yaffe and her colleagues, the pandemic happened halfway through this study. So a lot of us were a lot more sedentary during that. I suspect their findings would have been even more exciting had they not had that to contend with. But the result was that they saw some improvement in cognition, a subtle improvement of cognition at 24 months. So it's encouraging for sure. I wanted to spend a few moments to talk a little bit about this problem. So when I'm in clinic, I often have people ask what they can do to help their brain health. And we have just scratched the surface in the last 40 minutes of modifiable risk factors and this new science. And along with my colleague, Dr. Howard Feldman, we were chatting about how frustrating it is that there's all this exciting new science. We know so much more now than we did 10 or 20 years ago about brain health. But how do we get that across to the people who need it, to the public more widely? And Howard and I decided that we were going to create this educational platform. So we created something called HALT-AD, which is an app/website, can be done on the phone or the computer, developed here at UCSD. And we're currently studying whether or not it's optimized. There are versions in English and Spanish, which have been adapted for our regional Latino and Latina population, so kind of a cultural as well as a linguistic adaptation. And we're running a couple of small studies right now to figure out how best to tweak it, and also looking for more funding so we can launch it more widely. So HALT-AD stands for Healthy Activities and Lifestyles to Avoid Dementia, or, and excuse my accent, Hispanos y Alto a la Demencia. It's, as I mentioned, an educational program delivered online to provide quality information about modifiable risk factors. And we thought it was important to accompany the online program with psychosocial support groups so we could create some sense of community and have some face-to-face, Zoom face-to-face, but face-to-face nonetheless, time with a moderator who is a social worker and your colleagues who are going through the program with you. And some people really like that, and some people so far, it's a sort of take or leave, but that's getting at this kind of personalization and what people might like, and how people might want their brain health education. So this is the landing page for HALT-AD. And once you sign up, you fill out some questionnaires and you get a report on your brain health based on the information that he's given. And then you can set yourself goals for what you would like to improve. So, you know, some of us might be a little bit sedentary and have not the greatest diet and not really want to change our diet. And that's okay. Like, it's a very personalized choice, right? And we also want to encourage people to set reasonable goals, which they're really likely to attain and set themselves up for success. So based on their risks and their goals, they get a personalized learning program, and they get access to modules on all of these different areas, and we plan on adding more in the future too. So several of the modifiable risk factors we've already discussed. The platform looks a little bit like this, where you can play these different factors. There's a voiceover if you want it, or you can just read the material yourself. There are quizzes and other sort of gamified components of it. And we really try to present it in a way that's interesting and motivating. So that's HALT-AD. I wanted to just spend the last couple of minutes talking about what can you do today. So hopefully this has been interesting. And as we've talked maybe, or as you think about this later on today, you could identify your own risk factors. and think about what you can reasonably change. What might you want to address that? What's sort of worth it for you? And the best thing to do with changing habits is to make small changes that you're really likely to sustain. Because those small changes, if you do sustain them, can make a big impact on your health and specifically your brain health. You might want to make an appointment with your doctor if you have something like poorly controlled hypertension, if you have prediabetes or diabetes which hasn't been addressed or isn't stable, if you have sleep apnea or insomnia, and even if you feel like your sleep is just not very good and you're waking up feeling groggy or you're napping during the day or otherwise your sleep isn't efficient, you might have sleep apnea and just it not be recognized. So we can do home sleep tests now. It's not such a big deal as it used to be. Hearing loss, as I mentioned earlier, big low-hanging fruit with hearing loss and very common again with aging. I encourage everyone to get moving. So I've been sitting here talking to you. I'm going to go for a walk with the dogs later and definitely get out and enjoy the sunshine. And I want everyone to feel empowered. Like, I think that this is encouraging, right? We can do something about this. We can maintain our brain health. We might even be able to improve things. So I think that's good. And then I would encourage people to make science-based changes using psychology to help with bad habit busting. And there's some great reading material out there on that. And then if you're interested and you're motivated to join the study, we would love to have people join studies. So this is my little pitch for getting involved in some of our research. The QR code there and the website underneath is for our Alzheimer's Disease Research Center. We need healthy people too. And this is the website for WITS, the study that is really a passion project for myself and Dr. Sunderman. We would love to have the women in the audience look into that. So much of what we do, both at the Sign Institute and with research in general, is through philanthropy and generosity. So if that's something that you're able to do and want to do, please do consider it. And finally, I would like to thank some of my colleagues, my funding sources, and of course, anyone who has contributed to our studies. We couldn't do it without the participants. So thank you, and thanks for listening.
Thank you so much, Dr. Banks. It was such a fantastic talk. As you can imagine, we have a lot of questions for you.
Uh-oh.
Okay, they're great questions. So let's go ahead and get started. Sure. I'm just going to go in the order that they came in. So, opinion of brain boost or brain health supplements such as Prevagen and multivitamin, Centrum Silver, turmeric, et cetera.
So, that covers a lot of ground, right?
Yeah.
A multivitamin, there's been some encouraging research recently. And there's probably people walking around who have deficiencies where they don't know. So, taking a multivitamin, maybe that covers your bases. And definitely if someone is concerned, they should go and seek out medical advice and get blood tests and figure out if they have deficiencies. And, it's definitely something we do at the Memory Center all the time. So vitamins, you know, they have their place. If you don't have the deficiencies, then your body washes it out and it becomes, expensive. But you know, a multivitamin is not too much of an investment. Some of the supplements are cause frustration for a lot of us in brain health, I think, because there's not a ton of evidence to suggest that they're helpful. And people will come in and they'll be spending a ton of money on stuff that there isn't evidence for. And that was really one of the motivating factors for Halt AD. You know, there are things that we can do, which there's a huge body of evidence for now, which I hope I got across with the talk a little bit. And supplements in general are not in that category.
Yeah. Thank you so much for clarifying that, Dr. Banks. Okay. What are some risky medications that can be modified to help risk factors?
Yeah. So one of the most common ones is given sometimes for overactive bladder, oxybutynin. There are drugs that there's a lot of medications that can affect the processes of the brain. And some of them, you know, something like gabapentin, something that might be given for really good reason if you have neuropathy or something like that. It's often a sort of way up, and perhaps having a discussion with your doctors about whether or not there's alternatives to some of those medications. Some of the SSRIs can be detrimental. Definitely some allergy medications, Benadryl. There are medications which are really not ideal, and some of them are kind of over-the-counter as well. So being really mindful about what you're taking, including over-the-counter medications, because they can have a detrimental effect.
Great, thank you. Next question. Dr. Breston has a multivitamin he developed specifically for brain health. Does it help? I've heard this question a number of times.
I think I'll default to my first answer. You know, I think Ineth, maybe he knows something that the rest of us don't.
That's a good answer. Okay. Finger study, what cognitive training was used?
Oh, that's a good question. I would have to brush up on the exact details. I don't think it was one of the over-the-counter kind of things that we can buy. And it was in Finnish. So I think it was different. But yeah, we could definitely look that up.
Okay, great. You had a slide listing metformin as a helpful possibility. For current diabetics taking metformin, can this help?
Well, there's some interesting data to suggest that it might be protective. So I don't think that I can answer that definitively one way or the other, but it is potentially helpful. So yeah.
Great news. Okay. What are the age and other qualifications to participate in the HALT AD program?
Oh, that's a great question too. So we're currently running a couple of studies locally and with partners up in Seattle, which are going out through our medical colleagues. And we are looking to launch another study locally. So it's kind of watch this space with HALT-AD, because we're waiting for our next step, which will be coming soon. But in the meantime, we have these other two studies that we're waiting on the data for. So we'll be back in touch.
Okay, fantastic. This next one seems like a statement, but maybe it's a question. A fermented soy product, natokinase, supposedly clears plaque. Do you know about this, Dr. Banks?
I've heard mention and chitter chatter with the soy products in the past. I don't think too much has come of it, but I would be happy to be proven wrong.
Okay, great. Which medications are considered risky for dementia?
Yeah, so that one came up before, you know, Benadryl, oxybutynin, some of these medications that are for pain and things like that. Really thinking about the medications that you're on and having that discussion, really is a sort of a provider question with your physician or whoever's providing and prescribing your healthcare, and asking if they have a cognitive side effect, and if so, if there's something else that you can have. There's the Beers criteria, which is, you can look it up online. It gives you kind of points for the cognitive risk factors based on each medication. So it's something that we need to be looking at. Geriatricians are the best, and pharmacists at that. So you can also talk to your pharmacist about that, actually, if you're concerned.
Okay, great. We have a few questions that have come in, which I'm curious about. Have you looked at women taking HRT versus not HRT? And do we know, is this a risk factor?
So yeah, this is an excellent question. We are asking lots of questions about our women, from our women in WITS, about what they did or did not take and for how long and when. What we know from prior studies is, you know, the Women's Health Initiative was stopped early because of cancer side effects. But in terms of cognition, it does seem like when you take your HRT is important. So there's kind of a critical period closer to the time of menopause. Some women, I believe, were being prescribed it much later, which was not helpful from a cognition standpoint. But if you're prescribed it earlier, it might be helpful. You know, menopause is such an interesting topic, and sleep is impacted massively. Mood is impacted. Cognition itself is impacted, and it's all kind of this tangle. We need to know more about it. We would love to run a version of WITS called WITS Junior, where we look at the perimenopausal phase. So far, we have not been able to get the funding for that, but we will continue to try because it's such an important question.
Yeah, thank you for that. Okay, we have just a few more questions left. Tell me about diversity in your studies. Did you consider that?
Yes, we are considering that. And I didn't touch on that very much in this talk, but we have WITS, which requires lumbar punctures, it requires PET scans, it requires a lot of invasive data collection, which unfortunately has been a barrier to diversity in studies due to a history of structural racism in this country and mistrust in the medical system and all sorts of complex psychosocial societal issues. We have struggled to diversify that sample. Because of that, and because Black women are probably at the highest risk in this country of any demographic group for getting Alzheimer's and related dementias, we've launched a separate study called BWITS, which is specifically focused on Black women. I didn't go into it today in the talk, but I could talk about it for hours. We're just launching it now. We don't have any data yet. We've taken a year with our community advisory board to really try and make sure that we're doing it in a helpful way. And we're doing this in collaboration with colleagues Mark Norman here at UCSD and April Thames up in LA, who have experience in diversity research and experience specifically in these communities. And BWITS will actually go into the community, and rather than asking for lumbar punctures and all that, we will just be using blood samples and cognitive testing and sleep and all that kind of thing. Of course, any woman in BWITS is welcome to join WITS as well if she wants to do all of those components, but we're really excited about BWITS. And then we're also involved in a study called Solinka, which is looking specifically at Latinas and Latinos, and that's throughout the country. So getting involved with more diverse groups is really, really important. As I mentioned in the talk, people who are not white are at elevated risk generally in this country from Alzheimer's. And we know the least about some of these minoritized groups. So really important.
Great. Thank you. And I think we have time for just one last question. Is there a maximum age after which no lifestyle changes seem to be effective in reducing risk?
That's a great question too. And there's some amazing research coming out of Claudia Cowis's group up in Irvine, looking at the oldest old people who are over 90 or over 100 even. And it still seems to be somewhat protective. I don't know that we know enough to say, you know, is there an age where it's okay just to be a couch potato? But I think what we tend to see in those really successful aging groups who get up to those age groups and are still cognitively sharp is that they tend to have a lot of protective lifestyle factors already.
That's great. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Banks, for such an amazing talk. I think I speak for everybody that attended today. It was just fantastic. I want to thank all of you who spent your afternoon with us today. Thank you so very much. A reminder that if you benefit from these talks, please do consider donating to us at aging.ucsd.edu. And thank you so much, Dr. Banks.
Thank you for the invitation. Jason.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.